Poetry from the right side of the brain.
Well, I'm pretty much working from the right brain. Yeah, I don't want to brag, but that's just where I'm coming from. I write from dreams and I write from things I don't understand.
That's Jean Valentine. We talked to her today about her latest volume of poetry, Break the Glass. And in the second half of the show, we air an encore interview with Tracy Kidder about his book Mountains Beyond Mountains. It's about Paul Farmer and his work in Haiti with Partners in Health. One of the poems in Jean Valentine's book, Break the Glass, is about Paul Farmer. Poet Jean Valentine's work is often short, honed down to a few spare images that strike right into the underbelly of consciousness and straight to the heart. The acclaimed poet Adrian Rich wrote of it, "Looking into a Jean Valentine poem is like looking into a lake. You can see your own outline and the shapes of the upper world, reflected among rocks, underwater life, glint of lost bottles, drifted leaves. The known and the familiar become one with the mysterious and half-wild, at the place where consciousness and the subliminal meet. This is a poetry of the highest order, because it lets us into spaces and meanings we couldn't approach in any other way." Jean Valentine won her first poetry award in 1965 for her first book, Dream Barker. In 2004, she won the National Book Award for her poetry collection, Door in the Mountain. She's just out with her 11th book of poetry, Break the Glass, published by Copper Canyon Press. For those of our listeners who are in the Western Massachusetts area, Jean Valentine will be reading from her work at the National Yiddish Book Center on the campus of Amherst College on Monday, March 7th at 8 p.m. Jean Valentine, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Now, you've been publishing since 1965. That's a long trajectory of poetry there. Your first book was Dream Barker, and Break the Glass has just been published. How do you see, as you look back over your work, how do you see that it's changed over the years?
That's a really good question. I think at the beginning, like many young poets, I think I was very influenced by what was around me in the way of poetry. And, you know, sort of learned by, I wouldn't want to think it was exactly copying, but I was certainly looking around to see what people were doing. There were not very many people my own age, so I was looking to the people ahead of me in age.
Such as
Elizabeth Bishop was very important to me. She'd have been a generation or so ahead of me. And I used to carry her books around with me everywhere, and partly because she was a woman, and the people I was being taught and my teachers were pretty much men. I graduated from college in 56, so there were women poets, and some of them I didn't know, or some of them I didn't take to that much going ahead of me, but I really took to Miss Bishop, and I loved, as we called her then, and I loved her poetry right from the start. And I think I was influenced by Robert Lowell, who was around then, and John Berryman was around then. I was aware of them, you know. But I think since the first book, I got more. I think it gives you a little bit of confidence to get a first book. You know, you think, well, maybe I can do this thing. And then it makes you a little freer, I think, in your writing, you know.
And you won a prize for that first book.
I did, yeah. I got the Yale Series of Younger Poets, which was one of the only prizes in those days, I think, or at least compared to today. But I'm glad there are more now.
So your work now is very spare. It kind of reminds me of, you know, how a craftsman, any kind of craftsman, gets simpler and more, I don't want to say efficient, because poetry isn't efficient, but gets simpler over time as they're able to kind of cut away what's not essential. Were you always spare, or have you done that over time?
I think it's happened over time. I think the first four books weren't so spare, you know, not as spare as they are now. And it's interesting you say efficiency, because I've heard people talk about poetry as some people's poetry who are rather spare, they talk about them as being very fast or quick or swift. You know, fast wouldn't be the right word, but having speed in what they do. And I suppose that means getting from one thing to another pretty quickly, rather than in a narrative, you don't want to do that. A narrative poem, you want to relish every line and every motion. It's a little bit different when you're doing something more spare.
And your work is also almost cryptic. And I'm not sure that's the right word either, but you have to work at it. I'm not sure whether it's more that you just enjoy it as a sense. I mean, there are many poems. I'm so glad you're here because there's so many poems that I want to say, I love this poem, but what is it about?
That's funny. I was just reading a book about the great Russian poet Mandelstam, and when they came to arrest him for the first time, he had papers everywhere on the floor of his poems. And not to compare you to the police, but a policeman picked up one of the poems and said, read it and threw it down on the floor again and said, what is it about? And Mandelstam said, yes, what is it about? And sometimes that's the only thing I can think of to say. It's not that I don't feel like I understand it a little bit myself, but I don't know what I can say that's useful about that, because I know people find it difficult and cryptic. And the only thing that might be helpful would be, I think what was helpful for me was when I got to know painting, which I don't do, but I just lived with a painter for a while, and so I was going around to galleries, and I was in his studio, and I was very, very soaked in painting for a period of years. And it wasn't that I even read anything, although I read a few things, I guess, about painting, but it was more the familiarity.
Well, it's almost like certain abstract art. Certainly your poems are far more understandable than I think some abstract art, but in the same sense that I get more of a feeling. The feeling is more easily accessible than all the meaning, let's say, in a more left-brain sense.
Well, I'm pretty much working from the right brain. Yeah, I don't want to brag, but that's just where I'm coming from. I write from dreams, and I write from things I don't understand.
And you have a kind of undercurrent, and sometimes more than undercurrent, of myth in your poetry.
Yeah, I'm trying not to be conscious of that, but I do see it when people point it out to me. The reason I say that I'm trying not to be conscious is that I feel a lot of times myths are sort of dragged in, like furniture almost, into not only poems, but into all kinds of art. And so I don't want to be doing that. And yet I do see that we're all, I suppose, influenced by them. And I do see that I am. And purposely sometimes I'll take someone like Eurydice and Orpheus. I just can't help it, you know. I can't think of any better way to do it.
Well, speaking of Eurydice and Orpheus, would you like to read the poem?
Sure. This is called Eurydice Who Guides. Eurydice who guides, Orpheus who guides, who first has to return to death. The one who sings, the one who opens first of all the animals, his mouth to her song, her thirst, his thirst, the ones who nurse each other. Don't be afraid, the blackened saucepan said. I met them in the country by a well, and once I drank from them, I never thirst.
Mm-hmm. Your poetry is really meant to be read.
Yes, I think all poetry is. You know, I think it's the closest thing we have to music, probably.
There's an incantatory sense.
Good, I would like that. I find when I'm going to hear other poets read, maybe I've read their book or their work, but I don't understand it. And then I go to the reading, and I come away understanding it. And I've heard many people say that, not just me. But it really helps, even if you do understand it. I think it helps to give depth to the work if you can not just hear the person, but see them too. I think it's mostly hearing, but I like to see the people too.
Now, but I do have to ask you about the blackened saucepan.
I have a friend who said, you've got to take that out. But it was really something I liked, but, you know, I don't completely understand it either. I can say, though, I was writing about the Orpheus and Eurydice in this case. I was thinking of the Mandelstams, as I often do, the poet and his wife, the Russian poet and his wife. She carried his, or so the story goes, that she memorized a lot of his poems, and then she had a lot of pages that she hadn't yet memorized, and she hid them in a saucepan. After his second arrest, she was traveling all over Russia, and if anybody saw those, they would destroy them, because there was such a Stalinist hatred of poetry that wasn't Stalinist. And so she took them all over, from one little town where she got a job to another little town where she'd get a job, and she'd be always memorizing them, but always trying to keep them in her memory because she wanted them to live. And I put the blackened in, but she did apparently carry them in a saucepan. And so that's pretty inexplicable if you didn't know that little story, but I just couldn't resist keeping it in anyway. I hope it's not too whimsical.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with poet Jean Valentine. Her newest poetry volume is Break the Glass. My favorite poems in the book are part of what I call the Lucy Cycle. Jean Valentine calls it that as well.
You know, I wasn't in charge of that Lucy Cycle. It just came to me, the whole thing.
And explain who this Lucy is.
I'm sorry, yeah, Lucy's... I have a whole thing about her, but she's a skeleton of a hominid 3.2 million years old that they found in Ethiopia. And she was, I think, if I've got it right, it was very exciting for them to discover this little skeleton, because she was only about 3 feet tall, I guess. But at the point where she was in evolution, the road was forking off to staying that way, and the other fork was to developing into us. Whether that was a good thing or not, I'm not so sure. But anyway, she was very moving to me because she carried her people of her time were able to stand up, and so they could carry their babies. And I was very moved by her when I saw her picture in a magazine, and I read a little tiny bit about her. I didn't really know anything about her, just what I've said.
And what moved you about her?
Well, her face moved me. They had a little photograph. You know how they reconstruct faces from bones, and they put hair on her and everything. For some reason, her face moved me, and I didn't expect that at all. You know, it was in AARP magazine, and I don't even usually look at it, and there it was, this face. And you know, I feel like she was our first mother.
I told Jean Valentine that my favorite poem of the Lucy Cycle is one called My Work of Art.
I'd love to read this, and also whoever's listening as well as you will have to put up with my terrible German accent just for two lines, but I'm one line. But I'm quoting Rilke, and I wanted to have one line of the German, just hoping that that would introduce us to the rest of his quotation.
And we should let people know you do translate those two lines in the next two lines.
That's right. So this is called My Work of Art for Lucy. It's a piece of brown wrapping paper taped to the wall, over the table, in this beautiful room with no pictures. First written across the top, it was as if she was standing across the road, waiting to see if anyone wanted to get to know her. Unquote. Then taped under that, and this is Rilke, Du, der du weißt und dessen weites Wissen, you who know and whose vast knowing is born of poverty, abundance of poverty, make it so the poor are no longer despised and thrown away. Look at them standing about like wildflowers, which have nowhere else to grow. Then a blue panther, a 26-cent stamp from Florida for postcards. Then a catalpa leaf, curving from its huge curving stem, the leaf a little broken in its passing from the west unto the east. And the note, I found this leaf on my way to the post office. Then Lucy Yu, hominid, sapiens, sapere, to taste, be wise. Your skeleton standing about like a wildflower. I'm glad you like Lucy.
Yeah, so say something about this. Was this something that you wrote? Was this a note to yourself?
This whole poem, you mean?
The brown paper.
Oh, that was actually a little work of, I mean, you know, it's not, but I pasted something up on the wall just like this, yeah. Mm-hmm. I describe it just as the way it was. I was in a at an artist colony. There was nothing on the walls, and I just felt like making something, you know. That was before I got the poem, though, but then I just put it into it.
Now, another poem, the longest one actually in the book, is for Reginald Shepherd, who died a few years ago of cancer. Did you know him?
I never met him, no, no.
One senses, one feels that you did.
I feel close to him, and I wish so much. I had friends who were telling me about him for years, but we never got to meet. But I feel very close to him. And someone told me when he was dying that he, I guess he had a blog, and one of the last poems he put up on his blog was one of my poems. So I was very moved that he was reading my poems, and I was sitting up here reading his, you know. So I felt a link to him, a connection. I wish I had known him.
Would you read that poem?
Yeah. In this poem, between these stanzas, I wait a little longer than I usually do because they're sort of separate little pieces, and so it'll take a little longer than it usually would. Okay, this is in memory of Reginald Shepherd, and the title is, If a Person Visits Someone in a Dream, in some cultures, the dreamer thanks them. Dear Reginald, it is morning. I sit at a table, writing a letter with a needle and thread. I pricked my finger, a pelican, out of her migratory path, even her language family, whose child is gone, yet she absently pecks at her breast. I write on the bedspread I am making for you there. May you breathe deeply and easily. If a person visits someone in a dream, in some cultures the dreamer thanks them in the morning for visiting their dream. I call it dream, not that I am drawn to that which withdraws, but to him pearled, asleep, who never withdraws. At a hotel in another star, the rooms were cold and damp. We were both at the desk at midnight, asking if they had any heaters. They had one heater. You are ill. Please you take it. Thank you for visiting my dream. Can you breathe all right? Break the glass. Shout. Break the glass. Force the room. Break the thread. Open the music behind the glass. Remember that blue vine grown alongside the gate, 14th century, Venus close as the moon, the bowl of the skull turning here, lifting that.
It's so beautiful. Tell me, pearled, yeah. Asleep?
Yeah, you have a very good eye for the unexplained. This is one of these things, like the saucepan, which nobody could understand this particular few lines unless I told them, but I felt that it was sometimes I make a judgment that I'm going to have it in there anyway. I don't mean to sound just willful. I don't do it at all in that spirit. But I think it brings something into it that wouldn't be there otherwise and that wouldn't be there if I explained it. So what it is I was on a plane with my friend Catherine, and she was reading, oh gosh, I forget who the author was. It was a philosopher, Heidegger. She was reading Heidegger. And she showed me a quote about how Heidegger said something like, being drawn to dreams is being drawn to that which withdraws. Now, I may have the quote wrong, but that's where I got drawn to that which withdraws. And I think he was saying that people who are drawn to dreams are drawn to that which withdraws. Because I remember saying to her on the plane, well, I don't think so at all. You know, I'm drawn to dreams, da-da-da. So that's, I think, right for the first two lines, or for the second line there. But I'm drawn, in other words, I'm drawn to him. But to him, pearled asleep. Those two words come out of the poem that I told you Reginald wrote in a poem of his, pearled asleep. So those words are his. And so I used them for him, to him pearled asleep, who never withdraws. But again, it wasn't Reginald personally, because I didn't know him. So it gets kind of out there. But I think I sort of test it on myself quite a while before I would print it, and I ask some friends. So I kind of hope it doesn't do too much harm anyway, putting these things into a poem.
And do you do that in general when you write? I mean, talk a little bit about the working and reworking of a poem.
Yeah, I work it as far as I can get it. And then I have three poet friends who I show it to, sometimes more, sometimes others. But these three particularly know my work well, and they will be very honest with me. They'll tell me if something isn't working for them. And yet they like my work in general, you know. So that seems to me the most helpful combination you could have, to show your work to somebody who is for it in general. It would be silly for me to show my work to, someone who didn't get this particular kind of writing anyway, you know. That wouldn't get us anywhere, but if they like what I'm doing in general, and then if they're strictly honest with me, like, for instance, they might have said something like, well, I don't get that three lines. And I'd say, but do you think it's okay for me to keep it in anyway? And they'd say, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, if they thought it was too incomprehensible for too long, they would say, I don't think you should do that. They wouldn't say should, but I have one friend particularly, she said, I don't get that. I usually get your poems, but I don't get that. So that's very helpful to me. And then I take it out, you know. But to him, pearled asleep, who never withdraws. In that case, I was really thinking of all I know about Reginald, which is his poetry. Mm-hmm. You know, I find it anything but withdrawn. And using those two words seemed to me beautiful, actually, for someone who was either dying or dead. Because you think of the dead as withdrawing, and I thought, well, not him, because we have his work.
There's such tenderness.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad. I'm glad you picked that up. I do feel, I guess, more sense of belonging to artists than anyone else. You know, sometimes they say, what is your community, or who do you identify with, or those questions. And I feel it. So even though I don't know him, didn't know him, I felt close to him, as if he was a family member. Almost.
We're talking with poet Jean Valentine. She was poet laureate of the state of New York from 2008 to 2010. She's just out with her latest book of poetry, Break the Glass. Then I want to ask you about the poem, a very short one, about Paul Farmer.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Paul, that's on page 23. And Paul Farmer is the doctor who started Partners in Health in Haiti. We've actually had Tracy Kidder on Writer's Voice, who is, and he's written a couple of books, actually. One, Mountains Beyond Mountains, and then another book about a protege of Paul Farmer's.
No, I haven't read that one. I read Mountains Beyond Mountains this same summer that I was writing these poems, and I loved it. And I, as anyone would, I love the work that they're doing, and I feel very moved by it. So this was written actually before the recent trouble in Haiti, but it was, I was so moved by this book. And by Paul Farmer, from Tracy Kidder's account, he's just giving his life to this. And it's, I think it's the only way we'll save ourselves, you know, is to, although I'm not doing that, but for people to want to help each other like that. And he's so dedicated. And I never saw the word soon dead before until I read that book. They use that word for some of the people. That they can tell they're soon dead. You know, they will soon be dead. Would you let me read this book? Okay. Who watches for Dr. Paul Farmer? Who watches on a moon surface hillside the soon dead children's rubber ball circle in an oval, sunstruck orbit from hand to hand? Kaj, Haiti, Earth.
You know, I think this is like one of the best, but very present poems.
Thank you. I didn't know if anybody would like this at all. And so I'm happy to hear you say that. There's so little in it, and yet I had nothing else to say except he's the one who's watching. You know, and all his friends who are working there.
And where did the image of the rubber ball, the soon-dead children's rubber ball, come from?
Well, I think that Tracy Kidder may have described a little, just kids throwing the ball to each other, the way kids do, you know. I think it was very literal, just came like that.
Poet Jean Valentine. We'll talk more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're hearing an interview I did in February with poet Jean Valentine about her latest book of poetry, Break the Glass, out from Copper Canyon Press. Ghost Elephants is one of the poems in the book. It turned out I had interpreted it completely differently from the meaning the poet had for it. But that didn't matter. For Valentine, meaning is fungible. Here she is reading the poem.
Okay, ghost elephants. In the elephant field, tall green ghost elephants with your cargo of summer leaves. At night, I heard you breathing at the window. Don't you ever think I'm not crying since you're away from me. Don't ever think I went free. At first, the goodbye had a lilt to it, maybe just a couple of months. But it was a beheading. Ghost elephant, reach down, cross me over.
So tell us about this poem.
It's a person who is lost to the writer, you know. They say the speaker. But they say the speaker for a good reason, I think, because it isn't always literally the writer who has lost somebody. But it's really talking about someone losing someone else. Although not in the case that I experienced through death and much less through a beheading. But there's quite a lot I could say here about where this came from. I'm not sure it explains the poem, you know, but it might be interesting to somebody. I was at a teaching situation in the summer on a beautiful campus which had very tall, tall trees. And I was just sitting out there with nothing to do for a little while, and I began to write this, and I thought of the place. I adore elephants, so I thought of this place as an elephant field with the elephants' legs being the trees and their cargo being the green leaves. So that was okay, so far, so good. That was where I got that. At night, I heard you breathing at the window was another literal thing where they had us put up in the dormitory, they were using those windmills. And so the windmill, at first, I didn't know what it was. I thought it was an animal outside the window because it felt like breathing. But then I realized it was so regular and so paced. And then I realized it was one of those big windmills that they have on their campus. And it was quite close to our little dormitory. So I loved that, you know, and it did feel like somebody breathing at the window. Maybe an elephant.
You know, now this is so interesting because, of course, I would not know any of that reading this poem. So I interpreted this poem in a completely different way. You know, to me, it meant, you know, the elephants that are going away and how we are, you know, their habitat is going away. And, you know, it happens gradually. It's not like a beheading, but, you know, before you know it, they're all gone. And so talk about the, you know, these two worlds, one of the poet and the other of the reader of poetry, and how they can each have totally different stories about the same thing. And is that okay?
It's absolutely okay. I'm very moved by how you saw it, and I think that's a more wonderful way to see it than the way I saw it, actually. But whether either of us reads it in a wonderful way or not, not to judge that, but just to say that anybody can read it any way they want. And I remember when I was teaching once, I got to have a Swedish poet, Tomas Tranströmer, who's a wonderful, wonderful poet, and he was visiting the class, and he read a poem, and then he talked about it a little bit. And one of the students said, "Mr. Tranströmer, is it okay if I see that in a different, if I see that poem in a different way?" And he said, "Absolutely. We write them. They're in the world. They belong to everybody. Whatever you see is fine."
So is the purpose of a poem to evoke rather than to explain?
Exactly. I think that's beautiful. It's to evoke. And I think when you try to explain, you get into trouble. It's like something is flying and it falls to the earth. You know? It's sort of like working in the dark with your intuition.
Is there a last poem here that you would like to read for us?
Well, let me read this just because it's open to this page. And this, some listeners might remember Grace Paley, who was a colleague of ours at Sarah Lawrence.
And a writer.
And a great writer. I should have said that first. She was a fabulous story writer, and she wrote poetry, too. And when she died, I wrote this very short poem, but I'd like to end on that, if that's okay. It's called On a Passenger Ferry, in memory of Grace Paley. The deck is big and crowded. In one corner, an old woman, sick, on chemo, not in pain, is writing in an elementary school notebook. Nobody else saw her, but I saw her. I had seen her before, her round, kind face, smiling and still as a photograph outside a window.
Thanks so much. Jean Valentine will read from her work on Monday, March 7th at 8 p.m. at the Yiddish Book Center at Amherst College. The event is free and open to the public. Go to writersvoice.net for more information. You can also find a link to more poetry by Jean Valentine and hear her read them. Next up, Tracy Kidder. Earlier, we heard Jean Valentine read a poem to Paul Farmer. Next up, Tracy Kidder. Earlier, we heard Jean Valentine read a poem to Paul Farmer. Let's listen to my 2010 interview with author Tracy Kidder about his 2003 book, Mountains About Mountains. It's about Paul Farmer's work in Haiti and the organization he founded, Partners in Health. I called Kidder up soon after the January 2010 earthquake in Haiti to talk about the book and Paul Farmer's work. I started out by asking Tracy Kidder what Partners in Health was doing right then in the wake of the earthquake.
Partners in Health has taken a leadership role in, I mean, for instance, they're the ones who've been coordinating and, arranging, I think, the transportation of critically injured patients to the U.S. Navy ship Comfort. They did take the lead role in getting the Central Hospital back up and running, and they were asked by the World Health Organization to coordinate the surgical activities there. They've been managing or getting up and running 24 different operating rooms, which are now going 24 hours a day. And that's thanks to an enormous voluntary effort from a whole lot of the American medical establishment. I mean, I think it includes places like Dartmouth-Hitchcock, Partners Healthcare in Boston, which, of course, is that huge conglomeration of Mass General and the Brigham and the Beth Israel and Children's and so on, the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, Mount Sinai, University of Pennsylvania Medical School. In any case, they were probably the first responders, or certainly some of the first responders, because Partners in Health, unlike far too many private aid organizations, particularly in Haiti, has striven for years, they've been there for 25 years, to make everything that they do there indigenous. They have 120 doctors, 600 nurses, 2,000 community health workers, roughly, and almost all of them are Haitian, and they're all very well trained. So they were in a position to react very quickly. In addition, you know, they were the largest single health provider in rural Haiti with about 1.3 million patients. But all of their facilities, all their hospitals and clinics, their 12 hospitals and clinics that they run closely with the Ministry of Health, are all out in the countryside, and they were not damaged by the earthquake. So very quickly they were setting up field hospitals in Port-au-Prince, and very quickly they were transporting patients out to their hospitals and receiving them, at their hospitals, and just floods of patients. They've also flown some patients to the Dominican Republic and even to the United States. So it's been an enormous effort. But in addition, you know, they helped set up a surgery center in a town outside Port-au-Prince. It's, last I heard, staffed by University of Miami surgeons. So it's been an enormous effort, and I think they've done, you know, yeoman's work. That's what they usually do, combine idealism and competence in all the countries where they work.
And so often that's not what's rewarded with this kind of responsibility. Talk about why.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So talk about why Partners in Health, you know, did get rewarded this time. Why were they uniquely positioned?
Well, because their hospitals weren't damaged, because they've been there for so long, and because it really is a Haitian operation, which is really unusual. I think that's the answer right there. And also, you know, they have extraordinary people at the top, like Paul Farmer and Ophelia Dahl. Paul Farmer, you know, in addition, is the deputy special envoy to Haiti, a UN job, and he should have an important role in designing the, you know, reconstruction of Haiti, which gives me a considerable hope. The big problem in Haiti, so far as private aid organizations are concerned, is that there are 10,000 of them, or more than 10,000 of them. And, you know, think about that. Think about the money that represents pouring into Haiti, and think about the results, which is, you know, I mean, Haiti's still one of the poorest countries in the world. So obviously something was wrong. And I think, speaking generally, I think what was wrong was not that all those 10,000 aid organizations were incompetent or weren't well-meaning, but that they weren't working together, and they weren't working with the government, and they weren't, you know, striving to make their projects indigenous. But not working with the government, I think, is one of the biggest issues. The usual excuse that a government is weak or suffers from corruption, it just doesn't hold. I mean, if you fail to work with a government that suffers from corruption, then you simply play into the hands of the parasites who exist in every government everywhere, including governments of ours, you know. But Partners in Health has striven to make the appropriate agencies of the Haitian government, which is constitutionally elected, by the way, full partners in everything they do. One of the big problems with this earthquake is that, in large part because of the history of Haiti and our role in the history of Haiti, the government such as it is there is very, very centralized in Port-au-Prince. And this earthquake absolutely decapitated the government. I mean, just destroyed it. Now, you know, it'll be some time before it can begin to get back on its feet. But the cultivation of better government, more effective government, more competent government, more honest government, that's crucial to the rebuilding of Haiti, it seems to me. And making projects that coordinating the projects of private aid organizations and foreign government involvement, coordinating all of those is really important, and making sure that those projects are Haitianized. That is, you know, it's harder to do it that way. It's not easy to do it. But if you want to come in and start rebuilding, you ought to be hiring Haitians. And you should be training Haitians in the creation and repair of infrastructure. It just makes sense if you think about it.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think of Afghanistan, for example. There is, the example of, and now I'm blanking on his name, the author.
Mortensen.
Yes, Greg Mortensen, where he found by enlisting the local population, they could build things faster and better that were used by the population for far less money.
Sure. Well, that's the other thing. I mean, Partners in Health, as I said, they have 1.3 million patients, and they do an extraordinary job. This is in what's called the Central Plateau and the Lower Artibonite. They have brought AIDS, tuberculosis, a host of and other infectious diseases under control in the Central Plateau. And, you know, this was something that 10 years ago, a lot of experts were saying just wasn't ever going to happen, wasn't possible. And they do this with remarkable economy. And the reason they can do it with remarkable economy is that their people are doing it are Haitian. And, you know, think of the effects of that. You now have these hundred and some we're really well-trained Haitian doctors, trained, I think, in the first instance by Paul Farmer and then by each other. You can make a virtuous cycle instead of a vicious one out of a... But if you just go in there and do it all in a sort of expatriate mode, in the end, your projects aren't going to last. You aren't going to create the sort of momentum that a country really needs in order to get out of the kind of mire that Haiti is in and has been in for a long time.
Yeah, and I wonder if you could also say, you know, I donated to Partners in Health, and I did so really feeling very secure.
Yeah.
In the sense that I felt that probably most of my most of what I donated was going to go to actual care.
Then you actually turn out to be right. Partners in Health spends 6% of donated money on administration, only 6%. That's a really low figure in the world of international aid, extremely low. So that means 94% of every dollar that's donated goes to direct services for, you know, the purchase of material, the salaries of doctors, you name it. That's the one great thing about Partners in Health. The thing that impressed me so much was that the money gets to the people the donors intended for. And that is not always the case, you know, and I think it's sort of horrifying. It's particularly not the case, has not been the case with a lot of USAID projects. We have these ridiculous policies where we tie our aid. Oxfam had a good article on this not so long ago. What I mean by tying our aid is that we insist that some of it go back to American pockets. So if, for instance, you're trying to do something in, I don't know, Afghanistan or wherever, and you have to fly there, if there are flights on an American-owned airline, you got to go on an American-owned airline, even if there's, you know, and that goes across, sort of across the board. And there are actually have been some USAID projects where fully half the money has gone back to, has never really left the Washington Beltway.
Or
I think that's obscene, frankly. And I think a lot of people... My sense is that a lot of people in the State Department and USAID agree and would like to
have it be different,
reform things. Yeah,
I read that Oxfam, or I read about the Oxfam article. I believe it's even worse than that in a way, because they were talking about how much agricultural aid in Haiti has actually
That's another issue. Yeah,
has destroyed indigenous rice farming in Haiti.
Well, it's really a crock. That's a sham, because I mean, after all, these are. This is food that, you know, the U.S. government has bought in order to prop up farm prices here, basically subsidies to our own farmers. So in a way, what we do is we subsidize our farmers at the expense of the Haitian ones. It's once again this business of a very powerful nation harming a small one. And I And that really ought to stop.
You know, I want to ask you whether this is true. I heard Ted Koppel say that Haiti, you know, when Haiti overthrew the French, they had to pay reparations, which took almost 250 years to pay off. And Koppel said that a lot of the payment was actually in Haiti's hardwood forests.
I don't know that, but I do know about the payment. It didn't happen immediately. These kidnapped West Africans who threw off their French masters, you know, finally the revolution was over in 1804 and the country was a burned ruin. And, you know, it was an unbelievably bloody revolution. But they, you know, they claimed their freedom. They created their own republic about 20 years later in the 1820s in any case. But see, the whole world shunned Haiti. Was the pariah nation. It's not that the Western powers ever stopped interfering in its affairs, but they refused to give it diplomatic recognition. And in part, in return for diplomatic recognition, Haiti had to pay the French reparations for their slave colony. Now, that's a really strange thing if you think about it. I'm a slave, and now I've got to pay you back because I've gone and got myself free. When Aristide made the great mistake, and the former president of Haiti made the great mistake not long before the coup that took him again, the second coup in 2003, I made the statement that France should pay reparations itself for those payments. That evoked tremendous indignation from French diplomats, although
a mistake?
I think it was a pretty good case, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, why is that a mistake?
Well, because at that time he was politically weakened and he was under attack from all sides.
He does play a part in this book. You open it with 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what was going on there. Why were you down there? And I should say before we go on that I'm talking with Tracy Kidder about his book Mountains Beyond Mountains. It's about Paul Farmer, the founder of Partners in Health.
Why was I there? I had gone down for the New Yorker magazine to write a story about American soldiers. I thought it was an interesting use of American military power. This is in 1994 when we had sent, I can't remember the numbers now, but something on the order of 20,000 troops to restore the constitutionally elected government of Haiti, which was headed by the enormously popular former parish priest Jean-Bertrand d'Aristide. He had been overthrown shortly after taking office by a military junta. You know, the saying, I think, quite accurate about the Haitian army was that it never had an enemy except the Haitian people. Anyway, they and then for 3 years, this junta ruled Haiti, really. And, you know, this is one episode where the word terror, it seems to me, was correctly used, terrorized the population. And we finally, under Bill Clinton, we sent troops and restored that government. It was a mixed bag, I think, that occupation. But anyway, I went down and I was hanging out with a bunch of Special Forces soldiers. Having been a soldier myself, I have a real soft spot for soldiers. And I was there one night and Paul Farmer showed up to talk to the commander of this little team of soldiers about a murder case.
And so did you know who he was?
Paul, no. Never heard of him before, but we talked cordially and I listened and took notes while he had this conversation with this young captain. And then I ran into him quite by accident on an airplane going back to Miami at Christmas time that year. And he was very generous with his time and began to interpret Haiti for me. Haiti is very confusing to people like me and to the soldiers I was with. It's, you know, for one thing, language. And for another, you know, the kinds of interpreters that usually soldiers usually get aren't necessarily very reliable. In any case, he was wonderfully generous with his time and information, and I saw him again briefly. But I didn't pursue him, even though I learned just the outlines of his life and work. And this is 94, but I didn't pursue him for 6 years after that. I think because Haiti had shocked me, and I think I also sensed that if I started following this guy around, he was going to disturb my peace of mind.
Really?
As he did, in fact. Yeah. Well, you know, I think if you, you know, I have a very privileged life, and I think that one loves to imagine that one has earned all one's privileges. And, you know, that kind of notion falls apart immediately when you go to a place like Haiti and you ask yourself a simple question like, what if I'd been born Haitian? What would my privileges look like then? I don't know. I'm not sure that that's why I didn't pursue them. I went and did something else. But finally, around the turn of the century, in late 1999, I met up with him at his hospital in Boston, the Brigham, and he invited me to travel with him for a month.
And he's a pretty... so he invited you to travel with him down to his clinic in Haiti.
Well, we went to Haiti, we went to Russia, we went to Paris, we went to... where else did we go? We went to Cuba. And then I wrote a profile of him for the New Yorker. And then he, after long thought, gave me access to write a book. And so then I went on traveling with him, traveled with him off and on for about 3 years, not all over the world, but over a lot of the world.
And he is, he comes across as a very genuine and warm, but also, fierce personality in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about who he is, what he's like.
Well, I think the basic thing about Paul, and by the way, you know, since I stopped scrutinizing him, I mean, I think I've done things in the correct order here. Maybe I should explain myself. I am now a biased journalist, biased towards Partners in Health, but I wasn't at the time. And I approached this subject with all the skepticism I'd acquired over 30 years of writing nonfiction stories. I think that makes it all the better. But now that I'm not scrutinizing him anymore, we're just friends, you know. And I don't idolize him, but I'm really glad that he's on this planet. He is first and foremost to me a doctor. That's what he really loves to do. I mean, this guy can remember lab data from patients 10, 15 years ago. And the way he remembers all this stuff about infectious diseases, it seems to me, is affective. That is, it's his affection for his patients that he remembers the patients, and then he remembers the pathophysiology and the remedies and the cases and so on. And I think that's where his basic strength comes from. I think there's another thing to say about him. You know, he's one of the most sophisticated, smartest people I've ever met. And in other ways, you know, he almost seems innocent in some ways. I mean, although he's not. I don't mean to suggest that he's naive, but to me, he seems like a guy. I mean, he loves herpetology, for instance. He's a gardener, you know. He loves growing things. He strikes me as a person who is in love with the world, absolutely in love with the world, and in direct proportion offended by these horrifying flaws in it, and by the terrible injustices that he, you know, first experienced in Haiti. And I think he went to Haiti soon after graduating from Duke, where he went on a full scholarship. And he had a very unusual childhood. And he spent about half of it living in a bus in a campground with his big family, and then on a leaky old 50-foot-long half-homemade boat that was moored in a bayou. And then he went to Duke on a full scholarship, and then he went to Haiti for a year. And I think he'd go in there thinking he was going to be an anthropologist, and I think by the time he got back, he knew he wanted to be a doctor as well, just because of the misery he'd seen there. And, you know, as he always does with everything, he began to study the history, and he began to become, you know, quite horrified by what our own country had done there.
We're talking with Tracy Kidder about Dr. Paul Farmer and the organization he founded, Partners in Health, which is taking a lead in the medical relief efforts in Haiti. Farmer and PIH were the subject of Kidder's 2003 book, Mountains Beyond Mountains. So Paul Farmer went to Haiti. He went with fresh eyes. Some of that may have had to do very much with the kind of childhood that he led.
Maybe.
And what do you feel was the key capacity that he had and the key lesson that he learned in developing this approach? And maybe just briefly tell us, you know, what is really kind of, in a nutshell, the approach of Partners in Health?
I think what they're trying to do is wherever they can, to first and foremost, to relieve suffering and pay attention to individual patients. And I think the technique has been to have individual patients teach them how to treat a family, and a family how to treat a village, and a village how to treat a region, and maybe then how to treat a country. And the two special skills, of course, that Paul and many of his colleagues have brought to this work, but in the early days especially, was both an anthropologist's eye and the clear knowledge that you had to speak, not just speak the language, but understand it, really understand it, so you knew connotations, and also, you know, skilled in medicine. And those two can be a pretty potent combination. Now, just to give you a quick example, it's very easy. I mean, you could read a lot of scholarly papers that say that belief in sorcery, for instance, in some countries is a real impediment to bringing modern medicine to them. But in fact, not if you're an anthropologist. Paul made, I had dozens of voodoo priests who were his patients, and they worked like for a while as virtual community health workers for him. Because if you're an anthropologist, you understand that culture is not a fixed thing, and that if you introduce a cure into a culture, you give some people some pills and on a regular basis, and they start not dying from symptoms that were killing everybody, you know, were always killing everybody before, people are going to look around and say, maybe I'd like those pills. But that doesn't mean they're going to stop believing in sorcery. And, in fact, there's a wonderful story in my book to that effect. So, you know, you don't want to go and make enemies of the local, you know, local voodoo priest if that's, you know, in a place like Haiti. You don't have to.
Mm-hmm. And you're really talking about a very profound respect for the people that he's working with.
Yeah, I mean, and it's also an effective one. Yeah, I mean, I think there is a line here. That doesn't mean that you think herbalism is more effective than antibiotics when you know damn well it isn't. But it does mean that, yeah, you want to be respectful, of course. I mean, why else would you be going down there to help these people?
One would think that, right?
Yeah, well, people have a lot of motives for this kind of work. Yeah. And some of them are really, truly beside the point. Even ones that, you know, at first blush look like they're good reasons. You know, there is at least one national pundit who the other day was saying that, you know, Haiti's extreme vulnerability to earthquakes and so on is just is a result of its desperate poverty, long-standing poverty. But this one national pundit wrote a column wanting to make you think that, you know, Haitian culture was to blame for Haiti's poverty. Well, don't you believe it? That's just utter nonsense.
Well, say more about that. Haiti's poverty, you mean because of the buildings? Why does Haiti's poverty make it more vulnerable to a pretty huge earthquake?
Well, isn't that obvious? I mean, you don't use reinforced concrete. You don't use, you know, good building materials because you don't have the money to supply them. You don't. A poor country also lacks, you know, expertise. It lacks basic good engineering, you know. That's why you have extreme vulnerability. Those buildings weren't built with earthquakes in mind, as they would be in San Francisco now or Los Angeles. Haiti is deforested, large parts of it, because of poverty, ultimately. And that has made it so vulnerable to floods that, I mean, it doesn't even take a hurricane anymore. A good tropical storm will kill thousands in floods.
And you feel some hope now?
Yes, I do. For one thing, Haitians are optimistic people, and they're tough. And I don't ever want to be in a position of declaring despair on their behalf, you know. But I also feel some hope because I do think that Partners in Health is, you know, it's big in Haiti, and it's offered the world a real model for how you might, to rebuild Haiti better, as Bill Clinton has put it, you really might be able to do it this time. I mean, people have been saying, oh, this will be a new day for Haiti for quite a while. But it does seem to me that that having PIH in what I hope will be a leadership role really might finally, you know, give the world a model for doing this.
Tracy Kidder, talking about Haiti and his book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, published in 2003. It's about Paul Farmer and Partners in Health. Our interview with Kidder first aired in February of 2010. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows. Plus, find out more about our guests and see videos or read book excerpts. You can also follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Thanks for listening. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.